Hey friends, if you live in or around Washington, D.C., we wanted to let you know about an exciting event hosted by our own Linda Holmes. Next Saturday, November 12th at 7:30 p.m., NPR presents an exclusive panel with the stars from Amazon's new show, Good Girls Revolt. Join us at the museum for lively discussion of journalism, politics, and the arts with stars Joy Bryant, Aaron Drake, and Genevieve Angelson, plus Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, journalist Lynn Povich, and producer Linda Obst. Tickets are going fast, so get yours now at nprpresents.org.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching and reading and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See, and I'm here in the studio with Glenn Weldon. Glenn writes about books. He writes about comic books. He writes about all kinds of stuff for NPR.org. And of course, he's my buddy here from Pop Culture Happy Hour. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fine. Now, you and I, as people hear this, have just returned from what I'm assuming was our triumphant tour of the West Coast.
You are, huh?
But because we are recovering from that tour, we are bringing you a repeat episode this week. We figured it was a good moment to think about one of our favorite episodes of the year, which was our show about Hamilton.
Yeah,
we loved Hamilton. There's lots to talk about, lots of aspects of Hamilton. So let's hear that conversation.
Hamilton is a musical currently on Broadway, written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who also wrote In the Heights. It's about the life of Alexander Hamilton, and it's primarily narrated by Aaron Burr, who eventually, 200-year-old, spoiler alert, killed Hamilton in a duel. They established this in the opening song, people.
Exactly.
Don't write us. A lot of the music is hip-hop and rap. The cast album is enormously popular and has already won a Grammy and has been stuck in my head now for about a week. And the tickets to the actual show are sold out until Infinity Month from now, so it is safe to say that Lin-Manuel Miranda has struck a nerve. Now, I am looking at my beloved Pop Culture Happy Hour colleagues, and I'm staring across the table at Mr. Dean Demby. You were more excited about seeing Hamilton not only than you have been about anything in the time I've known you, but probably more excited than anyone has ever been about anything at any time in the world. So you sat next to me,
yes,
vibrating with joy the entire time. This is—I would guess it's one of the few Broadway productions that ever had somebody shouting "Yeah!" between every song. What?
By the way, I would point out is the exactly right response to this show.
It was exactly the right response.
It's just Gene's. Gene was the rare person with the guts to do it.
Well, and there was a thunderous ovation in every situation.
Yeah.
But anyway, I may be giving away the answer to this question, but what did you think of Hamilton?
It was okay. No, it was amazing. I think the first time Glenn talked about the cast album forever ago, he shouted out, and it's an amazing cast album. I've been in love with this cast album. It's the most, like, my favorite piece of popular culture for the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a musical theater person. I actually sort of abhor musical theater, which is why I've said this to Linda like a million times when I walk by her desk. Like, I have no idea why I'm so obsessed with this thing.
Right.
So my expectations were really high. The cast album is amazing and it almost doesn't do it justice.
Yeah.
The thing the cast album can't really convey is just how kinetic the staging is and how much stuff is happening on the stage. You're listening to the cast album and you hear people singing and you don't realize that all of those people are, a lot of them are pretty much on stage the entire time and dancing around, having this Beyonce concert going every night.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have listened to this cast album on shuffle repeat, as I have, while working out, as I have.
On shuffle, so you're not getting it in narrative order.
Right. And that also means, because you're working out, when a slow song comes on, you skip it. you get, in your head, this vision of this show as this raw, aggressive thing that is just thumbing its nose at Broadway conventions, man. Like, take that, show tunes. And then you get into it, and it's jazz handsier than I thought it was going to be, because the opening number starts, and there are sleeveless chorus boys doing jazz hands. Like, now, if I had those arms, I would be sleeveless as well. But apparently jazz hands are really good for the tricep definition, it turns out. It's great choreography by Andrew Blankenbuehler, but it is familiar if you know Broadway. It's, Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. It's Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. It's Twyla, Twyla, Twyla. But it took me a while to understand. This is not trying to upend Broadway.
Right.
This is trying to fit into existing modes but broaden them.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that in a really, as you say, Gene, kinetic constantly in motion. The show does not stop.
Yeah, absolutely. Well done.
I had never seen an actual full-on Broadway production before. I'd seen touring companies. I've seen, like, Come to My Friend's one-man show. Mm-hmm. I've seen theater, but I had never seen, like, a full-on lavish Broadway musical. But first of all, I'm assuming it's all like this.
Oh, yeah. Everything exactly like this.
But also, I was struck by there's a lot of it that feels incredibly forceful and fresh and unlike anything I had ever seen. But there are also these through lines of very, very familiar tropes from all sorts of musicals, including like Disney musicals.
Yep.
You know, you have like a plucky hero who wants more than he currently has and who strives to make his mark. I mean, when you think about it, like, I'm not going to throw away my shot is Lose Yourself from 8 Mile.
Right.
You
it's know, an I Wish song.
It's an I Wish song. It's exactly an I Wish song. I know the action in the street is exciting, but Jesus, between all the bleeding and fighting, I've been reading and writing. We need to handle our financial situation. Are we a nation of states? What's the state of our nation? I'm past patiently waiting, I'm passionately smashing every expectation, every action's an act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties of sorrow. For the first time, I'm thinking past tomorrow. And I am not throwing away my shot.
For me, what I had heard about Hamilton, and I had decided not to listen to the cast album because right. I knew we were going.
Me too.
I decided not to listen to it, and what I had heard about it was, just like Stephen says, so much about the mold breaking and how different it is, which is absolutely true, right? It is absolutely hugely different. When I sat with Gene and was trying to come up with, like, so if you really like this, what other Broadway stuff might you listen to? You struggle to, like, fill in what that hole is. But at the same time, there's so much talk about this as a Broadway musical for people who don't like Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. This, for me, was a Broadway musical for people who love Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. And for me, there are so many pieces of this that are really familiar, not in a negative way, but that really illustrate that in addition to Miranda's deep love of hip-hop and rap, he has a deep love of Broadway and musicals. And so for me, there's a lot of stuff in this show that you would not hear in any other Broadway show. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of stuff in it that you could hear in any of, like, the what I would consider the modern, like, agony musicals.
Like, I'm in.
I mean, I think, like, Les Mis and Rent.
Sure. Oh, okay.
A show like Next to Normal, which is a show about mental illness. To some degree, I think Fun Home is probably in this category, although a little different balanced. I think that what those shows have developed is this respect for the ability of a Broadway musical to end in tension, to end in imperfect resolution, which is not just these kind of, as I said, modern agony musicals, but goes back to really like Sondheim in particular. Mm-hmm. Ends a lot of shows that way. Follies is very sad. I was listening today to Company, which is a Sondheim musical that's very emotionally complicated, and it leaves you in a very uncertain place. At the same time, I would also say Miranda, who I believe will eventually be a Broadway composer, seen very similarly to Sondheim or Richard Rodgers.
A towering figure.
I believe that.
He's only in his 30s.
I believe he's going to be one of the most important Broadway composers in the history of American musical theater. And in the stuff that he writes, it's so different and it's so vibrant, but you also, I hear so much Cole Porter in it and so much Sondheim in it.
Oh, the wordplay, the density of the wordplay.
Mm-hmm. So I brought a little tiny clip from Company. And a person's personality is personable. You should not have said like a bum. It's harder than a matador coercinable. Try to get you off of your rum. Now, that is Stephen Sondheim rhyming when a person's personality is personable with a matador coercing a bull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, that is exactly the kind of rhyme that is in Hamilton.
Yeah. Exactly. Expecting. We gotta go, gotta get the job done. Gotta start a new nation, gotta meet my son. Get the bullets out your gun, the bullets out your gun. We move undercover and we move as one. Through the night, we have one shot to live another day. We cannot let a stray gunshot give us away. We will fight up close, seize the moment and stay in it. It's either that or meet the business end of a bayonet. The code word is Rochambeau.
Musicals also have a super long history with these very densely packed explosions of words.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That goes back not only to, like, Gilbert and Sullivan did that, but, you know, tons and tons of composers. Again, Cole Porter was kind of a master of that, and I brought a little clip of that, too. This is the Danny Kaye. But honey, I suspect you all of being intellectual, and so instead of gushing on, let's have a big discussion on
timidity, stupidity, solidity, frigidity, avidity, turbidity, Manhattan, ambiguity, fatality, morality, legality, finality, neutrality, reality, or southern hospitality, pomposity, verbosity, I'm losing my velocity, but let's not talk about love.
So that is Danny Kaye singing the song Let's Not Talk About Love, which is a Cole Porter song. And I think, here's what I am not saying, right? Cole Porter invented rap and hip hop. Like, that's a horrible thing that people sometimes try to, like, the music man invented rap. Like, that is not at all the thing that I'm saying.
Right.
What I'm saying is what I love about this show is that the things that are different about it mesh in this wonderful way with things that I already love about Broadway.
I'm in the cabinet. I am complicit in watching them grabbing and power and kissing. If Washington isn't gonna listen to disciplined dissidents, this is the difference. This kid is out.
Oh, this immigrant isn't somebody we chose. Oh, this immigrant's keeping us all on our toes. Oh.
Well, and that's one thing I've heard about this production quite a bit is that it stashes Easter egg after Easter egg after Easter egg for musical enthusiasts.
Right. So I brought that too before I run out of air. The one that stuck out to me, I have been obsessed with the musical the last 5 years by Jason Robert Brown for a year and a half. Talk about it all the time. I'm going to play the Hamilton clip first.
I don't say no to this. There is nowhere I can go. Go.
So?
Nobody needs to know.
That's a clip from Hamilton. Here's a clip from the last 5 years.
All right, the panic recedes. Nobody needs to know.
So that is not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. That is a quote, as Miranda has talked about in Vulture in a long list of things that he quoted. That's in the song where the Hamilton song is about adultery. Mm-hmm. That is a song in the last 5 years about adultery. It refers to exactly the same thing, essentially. I think what's great about it is, for me, I am not nearly as likely to pick up hip hop and rap allusions as a lot of other people are.
Right.
But I am likely to pick up pieces of the Broadway stuff. There's also a quote from South Pacific and some other things, but that's kind of where I come down.
Now, when we were hanging out seeing this play, Gene, you were talking about how many different rappers' styles are incorporated by Lin-Manuel Miranda in this production, how each founding father, one has the style of Rakim.
Right, yeah.
There's Run DMC. You know, like, can you talk about that a little bit?
So Miranda sort of said that he wanted Hamilton to sort of clearly be someone who was ahead of his time. Mm-hmm. And so there's I think it's maybe the second song, right? We meet Aaron Burr. They're beatboxing on the table, or they're like drumming on the table. And it's a Hercules Mulligan.
I love Hercules Mulligan. Yeah.
How can you not love Hercules Mulligan? It's Hercules Mulligan, John Lawrence, and the Marquis de Lafayette.
Et oui, oui, mon ami, je m'appelle Lafayette, the Lancelot of the revolutionary set. I came from afar just to say bonsoir to the king, cause it's toi, who is the best, c'est moi.
Hamilton is supposed to be like, he's Rakim. He's like a decade after that, right? It's much denser. The rhymes are much denser.
Burr, the revolution's imminent. What do you stall for?
If you stand for nothing, Burr, what'll you fall for?
Who are you?
Who are you?
Who are you? Who is this kid? What's he gonna do?
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond.
I was listening to Lin-Manuel Miranda on Heaven and Tracy's show, Another Round. He was saying that Hercules Mulligan was based on Busta Rhymes. Just like really bombastic, just rhyming super fast, you know, like just really like, you know, bugging out all the time.
How did we know that this plan would work? We had a spy on the inside. That's right,
Hercules Mulligan!
I tell a spy on the British government. I take the measurements, information, and then I smuggle it. Up to my brother's revolutionary covenant. I'm running with the Sons of Liberty and I am loving it. See, that's what happens.
There's a lot of double casting in this play. Daveed Diggs plays Lafayette, who has to rhyme in a faux French accent in the first part. And really, really well. I mean, I don't know how he does the syllables with the accent, like, you know, convincingly.
I'm taking this horse by the reins, wicked red coat, weather with blood stains. Lafayette. And I'm never gonna stop until I make a drop, I burn them up and scatter the remains down.
Lafayette.
Watch me engaging them, escaping them, and raging them out.
Lafayette.
I go to France for more fun.
Lafayette.
I come back with more guns and ships. And so the balance shifts.
There are all sorts of hip-hop quotes, literal hip-hop quotes, in this play. Both Alexander Hamilton and his son, Philip, say, "I'm only 19 and my mind is older." That's a Mobb Deep line from Prodigy from Mobb Deep, Shook Ones. I can't imagine that there's a lot of overlap between the Mobb Deep audience and the Broadway audience, but... which is really clever and really nerdy, and I don't think I would have picked up on that.
Well, and it's just as Easter egg-y
as
dropping in quotes from other musicals. So Linda and I did not really listen to the cast album going in. We'd seen like the opening number on the Grammys, whatever. Mm-hmm. Gene, you spent like all of the months leading up to this doing nothing but listening to the cast album.
Sure.
Glenn,
as
much,
did I. No,
you,
I, over again. Over
you spent
and over
again. Months and months just listening.
I did
to
not
it.
Watch the Grammy thing because I didn't want to see.
Oh,
what it was
you
like
avoided the Grammys.
Well, interesting. It's tricky to do A/B testing here because we're different people. Mm-hmm. But like, did you feel advantaged or disadvantaged knowing all the songs going in?
For me, I didn't grow up listening to rap contain your shock. And so, I mean, I could, to this day, I could listen to Blondie's Rapture and be like, whoa, slow down, lady. You got in a car and you drove real far. Is that what you're telling me? All right. Mad flow. Well done. I needed help. I needed help with this. It's
By
very,
the way,
very fast.
You should know that Gene is dying about Mad Flow. Just over the corner, collapsing
hand
about
over face.
Mad
All
Flow.
Right. So I could understand the lyrics, and these lyrics are just packed, as you guys have mentioned. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, this show is so visually textured. Every number gets a different approach, and not necessarily the approach you would expect from the album. As you said, Gene, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening with a lot of people in the background. And yet, some of the biggest numbers are a dude in a follow spot belting, singing his guts out. Leslie Odom Jr. doing...
we got praise hands in the corner here.
Doing Wait For It. You imagine that because it is so powerful just listening to it. You imagine it's one of these big numbers where everybody's just kind of, you know, doing jazz hands all over the place. Uh-huh. And it's just him. Mm-hmm. And the songwriting of that song. I just want to spend a little bit of time just talking about the way this form follows function. Wait For It is a song about frustrated expectations, and over again, that song frustrates your expectations. You think it's a rising action. You think it's always going to bust out. It never busts out where you think it's going to bust out. This thing was, you're building a certain thing, and all of a sudden it undercuts with him saying, what is it like in his shoes?
What is it like in his shoes? Hamilton doesn't hesitate. He exhibits no restraint. Takes and he takes and he keeps winning anyway. Changes the game, plays and he raises the stakes. And if there's a reason he seems to thrive and so few survive, then goddammit, I'm willing to wait for it. I'm willing to wait for it. Life doesn't discriminate between the sinners and the saints. It takes and it takes and it takes.
That is meant to take you back and throttle you back. You keep wanting this song to break just like he wants to break out. It's so smart and assured. The big numbers are big, but not necessarily because there's a lot of people on stage.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's a difference between the numbers that really hit when you listen to the cast album and the numbers that really hit when you see it on stage. Because for me, some of the Thomas Jefferson stuff in the second act is the stuff that I loved the most when I saw it on stage. It doesn't pop as much for me if you don't see...
Oh.
What Daveed Diggs is doing,
kind of high kicking and scampering.
Well, and it's very like vaudeville-y and kind of like it's very. There's a dance, but it's not like a dance in a traditional sense. Mm-hmm. It's like a. It's just kind of like a dude.
Kind of a taunting strut.
It's like
almost.
A dude. It's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon in the best way. It's just like. I mean, I'm sure it is organized dancing. I'm not saying like he's just like screwing around. I'm saying. It doesn't come off like, look at the graceful dance. It comes off like it's this explosion of energy that happens to be, like Gene said earlier, kinetic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to give people the sense, because obviously a lot of people listening to this are interested in the show but haven't seen it yet. And even talking about it on social media, as we've been doing since we've seen it, there are a lot of people who are like, don't tell me anything.
Right.
I just wonder, like, I really liked having seen the opening number on the Grammys. To me, it helped... ease me into this show, which is full of all these very, very densely packed lyrics, like kind of just having that introduction of everybody, kind of knowing which one each person was going in and then seeing that again. I felt it really useful to have a few minutes of head start.
The two numbers that jumped out to me that I liked enough on the cast album, but like were like really incredibly rendered. I actually don't even know how to talk about Satisfied without ruining it for people. Mm-hmm. But Satisfied is a song sung by Angelica Schuyler, mm-hmm. who Alexander Hamilton is her intellectual equal. They have this tremendous chemistry, and he's marrying her sister. And so she's sort of regretting having introduced them.
Handsome boy, does he know it? Peach fuzz, then he can't even grow it. I want to take him far away from this place, then I turn and see my sister's face, and she is so clean. And I know she is.
And we happened to see it with the understudy Angelica.
And she was fantastic.
She was mm-hmm. fantastic.
She was unbelievable.
How did they just have brilliant understudies stacked like cordwood? Like, you see all these amazing people and you're like, these must be the best people at this there are.
Absolutely. The other song that jumped out to me on stage was One Last Time, which is sort of Washington's farewell. He's sort of saying, I'm going to step down from the presidency. Chris Jackson is a monster. He is unbelievable. I mean, he's singing his ass off on that song.
I think it's maybe the least flashy performance in the show, but it's so good.
It's so good. There's a moment in the song in which Hamilton is actually writing his farewell address. He's writing Washington's farewell address. And the way they sort of move out of Hamilton's voice into Washington's voice is really, really well done on stage.
I anticipate with pleasing expectation that retreat in which I promise myself to realize the sweet enjoyment of partaking in the midst of my fellow citizens. The benign influence of good laws and of a free government, the ever favorite object of my heart, and the happy reward, as I trust, of our mutual cares, labors, and dangers. One last time.
George Washington's going home.
I'll teach him how to say goodbye.
George Washington's going home.
You and I.
So you guys recommend him. That's what you're saying. Did you guys find as it shifted away from the rapping and into a little bit more song, just entirely like sung vocals, a few more ballads in that back half.
Yeah, but the back half is where the battles, where the rap battles are.
And they're the beginning of the back half.
I will say this too about what you're trying to say here. This is musicals. Like almost every show with a cast album or, you know, a score or whatever that I love has that part where you're like, nah, I don't care about this. Take me forward to this other stuff. You sort of get to that part where you're like, nah, whatever. And then she does the, nah, 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 and then they go, and then you skip. Mm-hmm. Like, and this, because the cast album is, the musical numbers are the whole show.
Right.
There's not really anything that happens in between.
You're essentially hearing the production, just audio.
You're basically hearing the production. For that reason, there's a ton of stuff. And some of it is getting work done. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Some of it is getting
just
narrative
doing the job
work
of
done,
narrative, yeah.
More than it is kind of showing off the absolute highest flishy flashy stuff in the score.
Flishy flashy. I like it.
Made it up.
How have we not mentioned Jonathan Groff as King George?
Oh. Yeah, well.
The real benefit I found to seeing it live with, I don't mean to brag, but very nice seats, was you could see the spittle pool up mm-hmm. on Jonathan Groff's lower lip as he
never flinched
as he swooped in with just these wonderful bits of comic relief. God, I love this production.
Yeah, it's like it's funny on the album, mm-hmm. but he plays that part. King George is supposed to be like very mannered, but he's clearly also a lunatic. Mm-hmm. And Groff sort of gets like right in the middle of that. Like he's both someone who is like very proper. He stands really upright, and there's like spit coming out of his eyes, and he's not.
But he also kind of has a point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no,
there are parts when King George talks a lot about how hard it is to actually govern yourself, and I was like, true.
What comes next? You've been freed. Do you know how hard it is to lead? You're on your own. Awesome. Wow. Do you have a clue what happens now?
The other thing that I wanted to say about King George that kind of goes back to the way that the show is structured is that it gets so much attention for being a hip-hop and rap show, which it is, but it also has a ton of other musical styles that are incorporated, some of which are kind of like I said, stuff that you can hear in kind of modern musical theater. Mm-hmm. But also, like, to me, the King George stuff sounds like the Monkees. And then there are certain, like, Wait For It is a song with kind of its own influences. The Room Where It Happens, which we haven't even talked about, is very much like, to me, I was thinking like Cab Calloway. It's mm-hmm. very, like, that's all jazz influences.
No one else was in the room where it happened. The room where it happened. The room where it happened. No one really knows how the party's ETS. The pieces that are sacrificed in every game of chess. We just assume that it happens. But no one else is in the room where it happens.
And there's elements of naturalism kind of creep on stage. There's my least favorite thing about musicals, my least favorite thing about theater is what's called stage business, which is what the people in the background do to pretend like they're going about their lives. And if it's like a musical like Oklahoma, it's always just people slapping their knees and kind of, and I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. It's so cheesy. There's a moment in the song when Thomas Jefferson comes back, and it's the first meeting of Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And it's tough to take your eyes off of Thomas Jefferson because DeVedek is so amazing. But if you happen to catch what's happening at the corner of the stage, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson meet. The focus goes back to Thomas Jefferson. George Washington comes up to Alexander Hamilton to say, what was that about? What was that exchange you guys just had? And it's there to deepen the characterization of Hamilton. It's exactly what Hamilton would have done. It's everything you know about the character, but it's there. It's hanging out. It's not the focus. It's just there to enrich the experience of the show.
Yeah.
And it's not overdone. Everything is just, it's there for you to notice, but not shoved in your face.
I want to hear Gene talk about how he feels about Wait For It.
Oh my gosh. So it's funny because, I mean, I've loved that song. It's like, I've played it every day. I've played it every day for the last couple of months. I wish I could be more critical about this production than I've been so far. That song, I mean, as you said, is like beautifully written. It's about this guy who is super, super emotionally opaque, right? He has all these ambitions that he doesn't sort of put out there, and this song is sort of him actually putting them out there and then reeling them back in, like, oh, catching himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Leslie Odom Jr. he's Aaron Burr. He's narrating the entire play, and this is like this sort of his, one of his big, he has a few numbers, but this is the, like, his sort of statement of purpose.
Yeah.
And as he's singing this song on stage, I swear, he was looking dead at me. Because I'm singing, I'm like mouthing along, I'm not singing, I would not sully
other people's experiences
with my voice. But you're
mouthing a lot of words. It was great. It was so great.
I was mouthing along with him, and I swear he's staring at me. I'm not sure. I'm 95% sure he was looking at me.
I am 95% sure he was staring at you too, because you were sitting like 2 feet. I mean, Broadway seats are very narrow.
Mm-hmm.
You were sitting directly shoulder to shoulder with me, and I'm like, he is making eye contact 2 feet to my left right now. Now, there may have been one reason for that, which, as you wrote about this and acknowledged this conversation we had, where I leaned over and said, "Well, yeah, of course, you're like one of like three black people in the audience."
Yeah, it was me and Leslie Odom, and maybe there was someone else. I don't know.
I saw one dude.
Okay,
there were a handful.
Off to our left.
Yeah, that was one of the things I noticed really quickly when we got there. And not, I mean, I guess it's not terribly surprising when you look at the demographics of what the Broadway audience looks like. But at first I threw this out on Twitter, like, hey, everyone, this play's amazing, blah, blah, blah. By the way, all the brown people in the theater were on the stage. That's the thing. We'll get back to that later. And people are like, oh, it must be about economics. It must be about money. But I think that's way too simple, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are all sort of entertainments that people of color spend money on.
As you said, like the Essence Festival, people spend a fortune on. Beyonce tickets, people spend a fortune on.
Right. There's something about Broadway that has all sorts of, like, I think, invisible barriers to entry for people. Culture of Broadway, I think a lot of people see it as sort of like a snooty or maybe, you know, like an unwelcoming place to be in. And so they don't go. I mean, I've only been to a few Broadway plays. And I'm thinking about them now, and they've all been plays that have starred people of color, like Fela in The Color Purple.
Mm-hmm.
It was jarring. And I think what surprised me about Hamilton is that so much of what's been held up about the play is that it is a race-bent retelling of the founding, right? All the people on stage are people of color, I think, except for one of the town criers and King George. And so it's a play that has sort of gotten a lot of acclaim for the way it's played with race, but the audience still looks very much like the traditional Broadway audience.
I had the experience of looking at a $10 bill recently and being like, what is this?
Yeah, I know. I did that too.
It changes the way some of the lines read. Obviously, you know, there's a line, you know, immigrants, we get the job done when Lafayette and Hamilton are talking to each other. Hamilton's from the Caribbean. Lafayette's obviously from France. But that obviously has a very different reading when you're talking about, you know, a Puerto Rican guy and you know, it's like you're talking about a bunch of people of color, right? That was one of the lines that got a big...
It got a huge reaction.
Yeah, in the audience, yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to really go do a 180. We're going to talk about a completely different topic. We are going to talk more about Hamilton.
More Hamilton!
So,
never too much.
So hang out just a second, and we will be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LEGO. Every girl is different, but research has shown that girls' self-esteem peaks at age 9, and confidence can begin to drop. They can become less likely to try, to take risks, to expose their vulnerability. LEGO encourages exploration and stimulates creativity. Whether it's with a Minecraft or a friend set, girls can keep building their world brick by brick. Learn more at Pinterest.com/LEGO.
Welcome back. Before the break, we talked a little bit about this musical called Hamilton. Now we're going to talk a little bit more about this musical called Hamilton. One of the questions that I had, because we wanted to talk a little bit more about Hamilton as a cultural phenomenon outside of the theater. And one of the questions that I had, I'm somebody who likes to relive things when I like them. I like to own them. I like to have them. So if I see
You're part of the problem.
I am totally part of the problem. If I see a movie in the theater, I then want to own the DVD or... I guess that I probably won't get to do that for very much longer, but I want to be able to relive it on demand. How would this play be changed on a DVD?
Well, here's my thing about this. I think that what you're seeing right now is a culture where more and more people are gravitating toward things that have an element of experience to them. Mm-hmm. More and more live events, more and more things that, in fact, you are present and nobody else is having quite the experience that you have had. I think part of the reason for that is that we do have such a duplication-based cultural economy where, like, anything that you can get, as long as it's digital, you can endlessly duplicate it and it doesn't degrade. You can share it with friends and it doesn't degrade. You can have infinity copies of something and they're all exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I think you can even apply this to stuff like movie making and the fact that you get so many, like, CG effects where once you perfect a CG effect... Like, you can tweak it until it is exactly what you want. Whereas with a practical effect, you're still dealing with real objects. And every time you put those real objects on film, they will look slightly different.
Yeah.
Every time you put actors on film, they will look slightly different. So to me, what I loved about seeing this is you are not able, no matter how much money you have and no matter how much money you spend on Hamilton tickets, you cannot purchase the experience. Mm-hmm. You can only purchase your experience. And I think whether that experience is with the cast album or in the Broadway theater, if you are privileged enough to do that, as we were, or if you see it when it starts touring, or if you see it when it's being performed in a high school, that is your...
Oh, there are going to be some terrible productions in high schools.
But that is
Idaho
your...
production of Hamilton.
That is your experience, right? And to me, the thing that I hope people are able to embrace about this and lots of other things is you are not trying to have the experience, because you can see from me talking to Gene and I are sitting next to each other, right? We're having very different experiences. All the Broadway stuff is landing with me. The familiarity, the like hominess of the Broadway stuff. Mm-hmm. Hominess, I said. the hominess of the Broadway stuff is landing with me. A totally different set of references are landing with Gene. And for Gene, as he talked about, like, he's not a musicals person. So to him, the part about being in a Broadway musical is the unfamiliar part. And to me, it's the most familiar part. And yet, a huge part of my experience of that show is that we were sitting next to each other.
Totally right,
like, that's a huge part of the experience I had. So to me, what I love about this is, like, I hope people can embrace the idea that whatever experience you have, that's your experience. Everybody sees it, even if you talk to people who have seen it in the theater. When we saw it, we saw the Angelica understudy, who was wonderful. There are enough principals in this cast that a decent number of people, when they see it, somebody's out.
Right. Sure.
You get a slightly different mix of people. You get a slightly different live performance every time. Lin-Manuel Miranda doesn't even do it one day a week.
Right.
Everybody I have seen talk about the other guy who does Hamilton says, he's wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'll never, it won't bother you at all. Do it anyway. And so everybody's having a different experience. And that is all the voice I have.
I personally, like, when a piece of entertainment is talked about as much as this has been talked about, mm-hmm. and to visit New York City is to have 6 dozen conversations about how and whether your life has intersected with the existence of this musical. Mm-hmm. When I hear this much about it, if I didn't have the enormous amount of Hamilton privilege that right. allowed me to go and see it for this show, my mindset is to reject it.
Yeah.
My mindset is like, oh my God, if people are waiting in line and spending $1,000 for tickets, there's this sour grapes, overhyped, you know, like all the klaxons go off telling me to avoid it. I think in part because I would worry, I think if I spent that much money and felt that much buildup and that much anticipation, that I would be sitting there interrogating my own feelings watching the production. Am I enjoying this worth X number of dollars? Hmm. Am I enjoying this as much as everyone has told me I was going to? And I get the sense that for some people, there is an instinct to knee-jerk reject this as a phenomenon.
I have muted a few Hamilton-related hashtags, I'll admit it.
Hamiltoons, ham for ham.
Nope, because there's a lot. But I think that all started to snowball once the cast album came out. Yeah. There's a period of time before the cast album came out when you heard about it. It's the cast album being out there and being the amazing thing that is the vector for this particular virus. And so I was part of it. I streamed it from NPR when it was very first launched. So I'm part of this. I'm not necessarily talking about it, but except, you know, on a show like this. So I'm the problem, basically.
I find it a disorienting experience to be on this side of the, like, evangelization, especially for, like, a Broadway play. Obviously, I'm not a Broadway musical person, but I remember saying really early on, like, oh, is this how Broadway people feel all the time when they listen to things, like just wanting to burst at the seams, like, you have to listen to this thing.
I went to see Sting do The Last Ship. And
and I can't actually imagine what it would be like to be, if I were on the outside of this, I might be, again, reflexively, like, anti-Hamilton, which terrifies me. Like, the sliding doors, alternate universe. That's why, right. I'm not having this ecstatic experience.
Exactly. That's not a Gene Demby you want to be.
No, not at all.
But it's funny because I've, in part, you know, I was loved the show and wanted mm-hmm. to relive the show in whatever way I could. And I also wanted to prepare for this discussion. I broke out the cast album, mm-hmm. listened to it over and over again. And it just, every song burrowed under my skin. I would have a piece of one of the ballads popping up. You know, look around, over here, the you know, not going to take away my shot. And just all these lines and like words would trigger the songs.
This is the experience that everybody has.
This is the experience right, that everyone has. And I tweeted about it the other night. And, oh my God, I got dozens of tweets back, like, of people throwing earworms at me and sort of and saying, like, oh, you know, oh my God, welcome, you're on the inside, you know, kind of, you're on the inside now. Mm-hmm. And it just made me like, wow, I already need to take a break from this.
Yeah, I have talked sometimes about the fact that I have found the phenomenon of it mm-hmm. very annoying at times. Very annoying.
I'd say
at times.
Exhausting.
Exhausting mm-hmm. way too much. And I still do. The fact that I now love this show does not make that any less true. however, I don't care. And the reason I don't care is that its overwhelming kind of preposterous phenomenon-ness is giving power to Lin-Manuel Miranda, yeah. power to David Diggs, power to Leslie Odom Jr. and all these other people who are associated with this show. And because that power is getting transferred into them so that they can do the next thing and make the next thing,
right.
the fact that it's, to me, completely overclocked, I don't mind at all.
Call me crazy. Call me attentive to my social media feeds.
Yeah.
But you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH, or you can find us on Twitter at PCHH. Let us know what you think of this plucky little Broadway musical. When we come back, we will bring you our last and favorite segment of this and every show, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So stick around.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals.
Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and now it is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Linda Holmes, what is making you, this is all out of order. The world has gone topsy-turvy.
The world has gone topsy-turvy.
What is making you happy this week, buddy?
So what is making me happy this week? You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in late night that I find, you know, kind of gimmicky and silly. And this is probably one of those things. I cannot promise that it's completely spontaneous. Anna Kendrick was on Stephen Colbert this week, and then this happened.
Could you give me a note for Falling in Love is Wonderful? Do you know that one? They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful. So they say.
Ooh.
And with a moon up above, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. So they tell me.
Because of the current state of my voice, I'm going to do the favor of not singing along. But that is, they say that Falling in Love is Wonderful from Annie Get Your Gun. It's a completely charming, completely pointless, meaningless, does nothing for you moment that just brings out how incredibly cool both of those people are in my book. I've loved her in a bunch of things. He, incidentally, I made reference earlier to Company. There is also a production of Stephen Sondheim's Company that Stephen Colbert was in that you can find, I believe, on your streaming services.
Wow.
Which Neil Patrick Harris is also in, and some other wonderful people. It's a great cast.
It is a great cast.
It was very well done. And so, you know, great musical theater people. So that is what is making me happy this week.
Thank you, Linda. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I wrote a book that is coming out March 22nd, Tuesday, March 22nd. It's called The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture, and it's finally coming out. And if everyone listening to the sound of my voice would just buy the 10 copies, just the 10, make it 15, because, you know, everybody's got cousins, I could finally, you know, give John Grisham a run for his damn money. There are two events around the book launch. The first is in Brooklyn on March 22nd at 7 o'clock at the Word Bookstore in Brooklyn. I will be there with Alexander Chi, the great Alexander Chi, who just wrote the great novel Queen of the Night. We'll be in discussion. He's a nerd. It'll be great. It'll be fun. And then the following week on March 29th here in D.C. at Kramer Books at 6:30 on March 29th, I will be in discussion again with someone you might have heard of, one Miss Linda Holmes. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to the book being out. Second thing is we did have a podcast meetup in Brooklyn that was great. And those things are always fantastic, even though they, for me, require human interaction, which is not, you know, my métier, shall we say.
And I had, at that point, no voice at all.
Exactly. So basically, Stephen had to kind of do hand signals for you. Yes, it was crazy. So to move past moments of awkwardness when I can tell people are looking at me to be more entertaining than I know myself to be, I would ask them, what podcast do you listen to? What other podcast do you listen to? Because if you listen to the show, we probably share a sensibility. And that turned out to be true because a lot of what I heard was stuff I'm already listening to because I listen to way too many podcasts. So I'm going to be going through several over the next few weeks of podcasts that were recommended to me that I can, in fact, say, yeah, you should try it. It's the first one is Hello from the Magic Tavern. The premise is that it's a guy from Chicago who falls into a magic portal behind a Burger King into the magical land of Foon, which is your basic D&D fantasy setting. He sets up a podcast there where he interviews local celebrities, notable figures in this land, in the magic tavern of the title. And it is, you know, 40 minutes of long-form improv, but the thing is that this improv has consequences because anything that is said in episode one must be kind of, this world gets slowly built over the course of this thing has been going on for about a year or so now.
Wow.
So everything that is said keeps building out and building out. So stuff that they throw out has to be kind of come back. And so we have a massive reality that's all based on some very, very funny improv. So I do recommend that. That is Hello from the Magic Tavern.
Thank you, Glenn. Gene Demby, what is making you happy, buddy?
I have two things. One of them, The Americans, by the time this aired, The Americans, the fourth season, I guess, we'll be back on FX. It is probably the best drama on TV. It is unbelievably tense. Mm-hmm. It is the kind of show that will linger with you after an episode ends. It can be violent, but it's not especially violent. The suspense comes from really the family interactions. If you don't know the premise of the show, it's a show about there are two Soviet spies who have moved to the United States in the early 80s to go deep cover and to do espionage. They have a family, though. Their children are being raised American. And so the suspense, a lot of the suspense comes from the family drama and their, especially their oldest daughter, who is a teenager, about 13 or 14. The other thing I wanted to shout out is actually from a few months ago. This is my obligatory Philly shout out. The Thrillist did an oral history of Double Dare, which I don't remember. Don't know if any of you remember. Back in the early days of Nickelodeon, it was this game show that was really an excuse to like throw kids into like probably dangerous stunts. It's a trivia show. If you don't answer a question, if you pass on a question three times, you have to do a physical challenge. The physical challenge often involved, you know, whipped cream or slime or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the oral history is great because as I was a 7 or 8 year old when the show was on, but I forget that it was run by a bunch of adults who had to like actually produce the show, several of those shows a day in Philly. And it was super low budget at first. And it was hosted by Mark Summers, who also famously had OCD, and he was working on the messiest show probably in the history of television. And so the oral history of Double Dare on the Thrillist is a very funny, sort of cynical look at the show that became, in a lot of ways, one of the big pillars of Nickelodeon before Nickelodeon was Nickelodeon.
Thank you, Gene Demby. What is making me happy this week is the outpouring of love and emotion and appreciation for the winner of NPR Music's Tiny Desk Contest. Now, I know this sounds like I'm just log rolling for my own department's little pet projects.
It does.
It does. Mm-hmm. It is, and I do not care. I've loved both of the winners. We've done this contest 2 years in a row. Last year, it was won by a guy who performs under the name Fantastic Negrito, who was just a phenomenal showman and just a ball of charisma and energy. And that was he was a great pick. This year, it's a woman named Galen Lee from Duluth, Minnesota, upper Midwest represent. And she came in I heard her voice, and just her speaking voice just has that beautiful upper Minnesota accent. Mm-hmm. This song that she performed that won this contest, we received more than 6,000 entries as we did last year. We did a call out, send us a video of you or your band performing an original song behind a desk, whatever that desk is. And we got metal songs and any number, like every genre you can imagine. The first minute of the song, you just hear violin, and the camera's focus is entirely off of her. It's just on like an instrument case, and you hear these loops being created. And about a minute into the song, it pans over to her face. And Galen Lee has brittle bone disease, and she's in a wheelchair. Brittle bone disease very much affects the length and strength of your limbs. She's in a wheelchair, and she's got a violin propped up like a cello. As the song is unfolding and unfurling, it is just the most intoxicating melody. I have not yet encountered somebody who has heard this song and not been completely smitten by it. She's already sort of claimed her prize. She's come in and performed a full Tiny Desk concert the other day. It's already online, and it is so beautiful. I just really encourage people to seek it out. I always encourage people to check out Tiny Desk concerts and everything, but this one is really special and beautiful. And that first song, Someday We'll Linger in the Sun, please check out and just marinate in that beautiful, beautiful song. And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. You can find Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C. You can find Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon. You can find Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. You can find our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you right back here